welcome everyone to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 182. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me today, Greg Lay.
Hello.
John Lindemann.
What up?
And James Jones, hanging on by a thread.
Hey.
Yep. James still not feeling too well. Sorry to hear that, man.
Yeah.
We'll go easy on you, all right? So, this week in new business, James is up first with some exciting news.
Yeah, so...
Which won't sound very exciting.
Yeah, well, you know, this is the best my voice has sounded all week, so...
I gotcha.
Yeah, so this week I finally got my Xbox back after going through the customer advocate who basically must have threatened to kill someone's dog because I got it within a week of contacting him, which is not bad. I'm almost afraid to turn it on because, you know, I don't want to go through the last 2 months again.
So you're gun shy now.
Yeah. So I did turn it on and play it. Absolutely love it on the big TV. It's so nice. Yeah. So as you can predict, that means I've gone back to The Last Remnant, although I still haven't fucking beaten it. Because the game's even fucking longer than I thought it was.
The game won't die.
I was like, clearly this is the last battle. And then, no, it's not. It just goes on for 2 hours. So, you know, I was only about 4 or 5 hours into Dawn of the New World when we last spoke. Since then, we got 16 inches of snow on Saturday, so I had plenty of time. I've burned up the 20 hours in the intervening week. I actually really liked the game. I was going to come in here and completely tear apart TYP's review. Then I got to, he mentioned that they have a really long, really, really long training session, and they don't even tell you how to use the animals. And I was like, ah, it's not that bad. And then I fucking found out that I could have evolved my animals like half a game ago, and they had stopped growing because I didn't realize, A, they evolve, and B, how to do it. And I just stumbled across it by accident. So, yeah, they don't explain shit. And yet. But it's a pretty solid game.
And yeah, there's a new Tales game for Wii in Japan. Was it Tales of Graces?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, it's been a pretty big hit over there. I think actually, apparently it's the only thing keeping Namco Bandai alive right now.
Yeah, pretty much.
I think so, yeah.
So I expect that to come to America eventually.
Yeah, I would be happy if it did.
And that one was actually built ground up for the Wii, whereas Dawn of the New World, I think, was pretty much a quick, you know, a quick follow-up to Tales of Symphonia, where they used a lot of the same assets and
yeah.
Similar
engine. I mean, it's the same world, so...
Yeah.
I mean, it is kind of neat to see, you know, what happened to the world after the events of the final game. Because in the in the previous game, two worlds were united into a single world, but you never got to explore that. Because that's the end of the fucking game when that happens.
Right.
So, you get to come around 2 years later and see what the effects of what you did were on both the people and the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it fucked things up pretty badly, so it's nice.
And you're reviewing a game right now as well.
I'm also reviewing The Glory of Heracles, which I'm a few hours into.
Is it glorious?
It's not glorious at all. And if we were going to talk about games that beat you to death with tutorials, holy shit. At an hour 40, I was still getting tutorials constantly on things like how to tap your enemy to attack them. It's got the most reserved battle system ever. I mean, it's super conservative. It's basically Final Fantasy II battle system, except there's depth in the formation, and it's not even a three person depth. It's too deep. You know, you can be back one row and attack people in the row in front of you, or you could be on the front row and take more damage and do more damage.
How do the graphics look to you in person? Because like when I've seen videos and screenshots, it looks weird.
It is weird. The sprites they're not the same style as the background. They're very strange looking, but they move really fluidly. You know, they exist in that environment, and you know their animation's really nice, but they don't really seem to be in that environment.
Hmm.
I don't know. It's hard to describe. I mean, it's okay.
Well, Baten Kaitos was kind of like that, right? You had kind of crappy looking characters over gorgeous backgrounds, and they look so different from each other.
Yeah, but they were the same style at least. I mean, these stylistically almost feel different.
Hmm.
I mean, they just look very plasticky. The characters do. I don't know. It's really weird.
So other than that, would you say it's like a very traditional RPG? You kind of no surprises?
So far, none really. I mean, they even follow the same awesome story mechanic of your main character has lost his memory, which we've never done before. In fact, all three RPGs I'm playing, the main character at some point lost their memory. So it's kind of a a well-worn story groove. That's about as pioneering as The Glory of Heracles gets, really.
I don't think I could play three RPGs at a time. That's like reading five novels at the same time.
Yeah, I don't think I could play three RPGs in a year.
The sad thing is, I can't really either easily. Like, I was almost upset when the Xbox came back, so I'm like, ah, damn it.
Now I have a third one. I have to go back to the last one.
I have a third one to chew up.
Well, on that subject, though, I mean, you had two big sort of first-party sponsored Wii RPGs get announced recently with The Last Story and the Xenoblade sort of is the re-announced Monado from Monolith Soft. Are you excited, James, that it's had
excited.
Its name changed? Are you more excited now?
No, I actually like the other name before.
What, Monado?
Monado sounds like a disease.
It sounds like a Spanish holiday resort or something.
I'm interested in them because of the developers, really. But
yeah, sure.
We'll see. But remember, it was Zengeki no Reginlev that's name scared the shit out of me. Because it went backwards.
Well, I think Xenoblade definitely has a lot of potential to be really good. I mean, certainly the trailers that we've seen of Monado look awesome.
Yes.
So if that game's getting rejiggered a little bit in terms of style or just even marketing, I think it does look really promising. And then The Last Story, that's from Sakaguchi, that's from Mistwalker, and, you know, they do have some former Final Fantasy people working on that, and it's a big-time RPG for Wii, and Sakaguchi, I mean, we don't know that much about it, but Sakaguchi did basically say, in so many words, he said, we're making a Final Fantasy for Wii.
Yeah,
it's like, The Last Story. I mean,
yeah, it's The Last Story.
It's not that dissimilar, is it?
Well, yeah. I mean,
it's not Final, it's Last.
What I'm confused about is I thought Mistwalker was founded with Microsoft money.
No, I think they just got a bunch of money to make, like, Blue Dragon.
Oh, okay. They were bled with Microsoft money.
It was kind of a Liberty City Stories episodes kind of deal.
Yeah.
So, I mean, eventually they even made they co-developed, I guess, Blue Dragon Plus for DS. But, yeah, that's really exciting. I mean, I don't know if we'll see either one in the U.S. before the end of the year. I wish, but we're still waiting for Dragon Quest IX, and they just got Dragon Quest VI out. So.
Yeah, I mean, in Japan, you look at, you know, what Tales of Grace is doing quite well, and then you've got Dragon Quest X on the horizon. I mean, I think the stage is set for a sort of burgeoning of the RPG market there.
It really is bizarre how well the RPGs are represented on a Wii after, what, 12 years of RPGs being completely desolate on Nintendo systems.
Yeah, and I mean, the Wii itself really didn't have a lot of RPGs until just recently.
And in the U.S., it's still really bad.
Yeah, it is.
I think probably the only RPG I can think of that I played for Wii in 2009 was Little King Story.
Yeah, and that's kind of on the edge there a little bit.
Pushing the definition.
Yeah, that's one of those genre benders.
Yeah, we've had some pretty bad stuff. You remember Opuna? That was like one of the real early RPGs. It sounded awful.
Baroque?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, Baroque, yeah. But I never met someone who played Baroque, so it's kind of a...
There was someone in the forums who was a huge fan of it, wanted to nominate it for Retroactive, and I was like, nah, I don't think so.
I saw it at the stores a few times, and I'm like, yep, that is Baroque. And I was like, yep, see you later, bitch. Like the cover art, I was like, no. Bye.
No, okay, come on, if he's going to go by cover art alone.
I do. Chouhaniki, hello?
Oh, yeah. Have you seen the music video for Chouhaniki?
No, actually, no, I did see that. I did not check out the link, but I will, though. I'm completely meaning to do that.
Looks crazy.
Yeah.
Well, next up in new business, we have John's iPhone Game of the Week.
No, actually, I do actually... my new business changed a little bit actually when I came home, Johnny. But I will let me just say
this.
My iPhone game of the week.
His gaming
is...
time increased by 5,000% because he sat down for 50 minutes.
Tough crowd as usual.
All right. Well, first off, let's try to guess what John played. I think this would be much more fun than having him.
Can
tell
we get
us.
The Jeopardy music, please?
Okay. Well, my iPhone game of the week is. Words with friends.
How
words
defeated was
friends.
That?
Kind of like what we're doing right now, guys. Words with friends.
Fucking Christ, John.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous, you know, because obviously I have an iPhone, and, you know, there are other people out there who have iPhones, and they recommend apps to me, and so a friend of mine at work, he's like, hey, you know, you should get this Words with Friends app, and I'm like, Words with Friends, wow, that sounds really lame. And he's like, no, man, you know, you should get it, and it is a Scrabble knockoff. But it's like the most addictive thing because it's basically lets you play Scrabble kind of
with friends
while you're at work.
Anywhere, yeah. I mean, it's silly. I feel like it's silly that I'm even really bringing it up because it's just such a basic game.
It is.
But
yes.
Like I'll be sitting there driving to work, and you know,
playing
because
Scrabble.
The thing is, you get a text. You know, when somebody else, you know, when you have a game going on with somebody, you know, you get a text message saying, "Hey, it's your turn."
This game was made by AT&T, wasn't it?
No, I don't know who made it. It's some little ridiculous company, but yeah. Words with Friends, if you have an iPhone, I highly recommend it.
John recommends you play it while driving.
Yes.
So let me get this straight. Is this like playing Scrabble in the fashion of a long-distance game of chess?
Yes.
Oh,
it is exactly
good.
That.
Yeah, I know. Can you combine two more boring concepts?
Hey, I like Scrabble. I really like
but
Scrabble.
But I like that it gives you a text message, which means that if you play a lot of this, your bill will go up.
Well,
that's
cool about it. What's cool about it is that, you know, you kind of have these epic games that stretch over several days, right?
Epic.
Oh, it's like Kasparov, eh?
So.
Epic fucking Scrabble.
It's Scrabble, man. Hey.
So, John, what was your other thing?
Well, my other new business was, as a lot of you out there will remember, the former director of the site, Steven Rodriguez, he had a whole bunch of kind of site, you know, kind of hardware that the site sort of, that we had to reclaim from him, right? So basically, what he sent me today was Japanese Wii.
Oh.
So, yeah, all of a sudden what Johnny has to say is kind of interesting. Yeah, isn't that
yes.
nice? Yeah, but he sent me, yeah, he had a Japanese Wii. He had a whole bunch of this stuff and just, you know, really never got around to kind of sending it over to us. But there's actually more in the package. So there's the Japanese Wii. He also sent over, let's see, some DK bongos.
Oh, nice. Good.
And a whole bunch of, like, kind of Nintendo DS sort of.
Did he send
random...
over his copy of Disaster? Come on.
Let's see. There's some games in here. This is like, I'm actually looking at this. This is the first time I'm looking. Okay, there's a freeloader for Wii. Interesting.
That's useful nowadays.
Yeah, really?
Yes, Disaster Day of Crisis. Hello.
Oh, it's there, John.
Yes.
I expect full reports.
Let's see. Winning 11, Playmaker 2008.
Yeah, I remember he did impressions of that as well.
So you can expect to see the eBay auction when?
Look at Disaster Day of Crisis. My God, it's like I'm holding a legend. And here is the Japanese version of Super Smash Bros. Brawl.
Oh, yeah, of course, the famous.
Yeah, Smash version of Brawl.
Well, but, do you have Sluggers? Do you have the
yes.
baseball? The
yes.
Mario baseball? Yeah.
Yes, that's the last game.
That's cool, man. So you'll get to talk about all kinds of stuff.
I think with Disaster, we should basically, like, John plays it, talks about it on the show, and then we start sending it around everyone, so everyone on staff has played that game.
Everyone can be embarrassed.
And the number of people who have played it will increase by 500%.
Yeah, there's actually some... I guess to match the freeloader here, I guess there's a bunch of GameCube games in here too, Japanese GameCube games. Capcom versus SNK 2 EO, Millionaire Fighting 2001.
Billionaire fighting.
Here is the.
Is it actually billionaires fighting?
Millionaires, James. I don't think they've made that much money.
I don't think Ken and Ryu get royalties.
No, I don't think they do. The Japanese version of Donkey Konga, obviously, to go along with the bongos. GT Cube, which is a racing game, apparently.
Yeah,
oh God,
not a good one.
No, it's a very bad one, actually.
But actually, John, you'll like Donkey Konga. The Japanese version's better, and it has
totally different music.
Yeah.
Oh, sweet.
I always would have liked to find the third version, which has got, like, 30 Famicom songs or something.
Right.
But you can't find that for anything approaching a reasonable price, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah.
Yeah, it came out very late.
All right, yeah, so there you go. So that was
nice.
That's, nice.
It's good to hear that Steven's still alive and kicking. It's been quite a while since I heard any update from him. So
yeah,
they can go in John's tomb.
Yep,
that's right.
Games go to die.
I'm sure my wife was just like, great. Now there's more stuff we don't have any room for. It's like this, like my game room is my tomb. It's ridiculous. It's just filled with boxes and crap and.
Well, if you didn't buy the elite edition of things with the big giant box, it wouldn't be such a problem.
That's true.
I know, man. I'm trying to change my ways.
On Japanese Wii, you could download the second Chouaniki game. So
well,
it's
I'm pretty
Turbo
sure
Z
you're
again.
Required to do that now.
Yeah, with that in mind, I mean, is there anything aside from that you would recommend, Greg?
Yeah, well, Rondo of Blood's finally coming out, so not really going to be so much of an issue, although it'd be kind of cheaper to do it with a Japanese, you wouldn't pay an import premium, but... Yeah, I mean, this. Hey, if you like shooters, Japanese virtual console's place to be. It's full of them.
Yeah.
Absolutely full of them. And a lot of them are really good.
Cool.
And speaking of shooters, Greg.
Yeah, very different kind of shooter. Mm-hmm. As promised, I've been playing Ratchet Clank and Crack in Time, the latest in the series of asinine ass jokes. The Ratchet and Clank of the Up Your Arsenal, Quest for Booty. Don't forget that one, that's good.
Oh.
Yeah, so this is probably the best one yet, leaving the title aside. I've really quite enjoyed this, actually. It's really quite good. I mean, I guess the main complaint that I read in the mostly very favourable reviews that I checked out before purchasing the game was just that it was, you know, a bit similar, really, not desperately different from the previous games in the series, which, of course, is not really a problem for me. So I guess I've just been enjoying it straight off. But, I mean, it's a similar sort of thing with Killzone 2 as well, because a lot of the complaints about that are like, well, it's kind of just another FPS, but again, not a problem for me.
when a whole genre is, quote, not a problem.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, you're in good shape.
Coming out of exile. So, yeah, I've been enjoying it quite a lot. And it is, you could kind of, coming into it at this stage, there is a definite feel that this series has been going on for quite a while without you knowing. Because there's just so many disparate gameplay elements layered on top of each other. You know, I guess they have to keep adding a certain amount of stuff that's new for people that have been playing them all along. But yeah, when you come into it cold, it's like there is so much different stuff. I mean, you've got like the kind of core Ratchet gameplay, which is, you know, the third person shooter, kind of very Jet Force Gemini-ish stuff. And you've got the Clank stuff now, which is this, you know, puzzle centric, time shifting gameplay. Then you've got, you explore in Ratchet Starship and get into little space battles that way. You've got various sort of little mini games you have to do at certain points, and you've got really some platforming heavy parts on these like planetoids, a bit like Mario Galaxy, but a lot bigger than most of the planetoids in Galaxy, which are kind of populate the overworld. The overworld will be, you know, just a sort of certain sector of space. And then between the major planets that you would go to with Ratchet, you've just got these little ones where you can land, and there'll be usually like one thing to find on there. And sometimes it's basically just like a big kill room. And then other times it's like some quite intricate platforming challenge of a sort that you don't really get in the sort of main levels. And they're pretty fun, actually. You know, I mean, they're where you could really call it a platformer. I mean, people do and kind of draw some of these comparisons to Galaxy and stuff, I guess, you know, because of some of the similar themes in the visual design and stuff. But for the most part, I mean, I wouldn't really, you know, platform elements are really light apart from these kind of quite self-contained little parts to it. And that's the thing. You've got a lot of these disparate parts that are kind of not really that strictly tied together, but they kind of do their best to make it feel cohesive. For instance, what you'll normally get on those little platformy parts are these things called Zony. They upgrade your starship, you know, like, so it's completely kind of separate sort of thing, but these upgrades to the starship are necessary to access the main levels themselves. So it's not just kind of totally peripheral. So, I mean, in addition to the whole Jet Force Gemini kind of thing, and the game sense of humour kind of reminds me a little bit of Rare, although not as British, obviously. But, you know, the whole game kind of feels like being thrown back into the Rare era a bit, which is obviously a very long time ago now. Which is kind of a kick for me. But in general, I would say every aspect of the game stands well enough that you don't feel like, oh, you know, not this bit. You know, I'd say the Clank parts with the puzzle solving where you duplicate yourself are my favourites because they're really quite clever. It takes a little to sort of wrap your head around at first, but they're not like hugely challenging, but they're definitely clever enough. It can get quite complicated where you're kind of record little runs of yourself, and then all these runs coexist. And they have to, you know, essentially kind of a bit like Spirit Tracks in a way, you're cooperating with yourself.
Yeah, there's some stuff like that in Braid that's a little hard to wrap your head around.
Right, I have yet to play Braid. Like, it's out on PSN now, so I think at some point I will give that a go.
I think you'll like it.
Yeah, everything I've read indicates that I will. So that's probably my favourite part. But, you know, the third-person shooting stuff is pretty fun. You know, you've got all these kind of ridiculous weapons that are interesting to muck around with. And again, if you've never played any of the Ratchet games, then they're all new to you. So you don't have to worry about, like, which ones are new or whatever. The character designs of kind of They remind me of, do you remember Ants? Oh, was that the dream, one of the first DreamWorks CG movies?
Yep.
Featuring the voice of Woody Allen.
I always wanted Woody Allen and Sylvester Stallone to be in a film together, but that really wasn't what I'd envisioned. So, yeah, that'd be like the, especially the Lombaxes or the ratchet sort of creature design. It's just the facial, even though it's like, it's some sort of cat, which is nothing like an insect. It looks so much like something straight out of Ants. It's kind of weird. And also, of course, that was back in the days when the letter Z hadn't been permanently associated with Ubisoft. So I'm not a huge fan of the character design, but the visuals are seriously impressive. You know, really very beautiful, very luminescent kind of quality. The animation's very fluid. Sort of spoke about the frame rate last week. It's all, really, really expressive and definitely has a personality, even if it's not like that endearing. I mean, I guess it kind of reminds me a little bit of like the Clone Wars cartoon CG show.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I think kids would definitely get a kick out of it, or a lot of kids would. And it's certainly bearable for everyone else. So, I mean, I really enjoyed this. It's a little less focused than a lot of the games I'm accustomed to playing, but you know, there's an argument for mixing it up, and none of it ever seems to outstay its welcome.
Cool. Well, I think you've convinced me to give it a shot sometime. So, it comes down to me to wrap up the segment, and this week I've been largely playing Assassin's Creed 2. It was the third of the package of games that I bought in early January. I'm really enjoying it. I'm not finding that it's that much different than the first Assassin's Creed, which is funny because I just remember when this came out back in November or whatever, I heard a lot of people talking about it and read a lot of reviews of it that seemed to indicate that it was like dramatically better than the first game.
Yeah, that's what I've heard entirely.
They never get into the first one and they love the second one so much more. And I really don't think there's a whole lot of difference. I think a lot of people look at the first Assassin's Creed through shit-colored glasses, unjustifiably.
Well, there was certainly a sector of the gaming media that didn't like it very much at the time, with the primary criticism being about the repetitiousness, and I was certainly under the impression that this gave a much broader range of tasks to do. Is that accurate, or do you think that's been overblown?
You know, maybe it's just that I'm still fairly early in the game, and the sequel does seem to take longer to get going. It's more a little more of a guided experience early on, where, you know, they're kind of feeding you missions. There's less roaming around and looking for things. But so far I feel like most of the things that I'm doing I did in the first game. I'm not really finding that there's a whole lot of variety. The one thing that I've done so far, at least, and I think I'm about, I don't know, 20 or 25% through the game, the one thing that they've introduced that wasn't in the first Assassin's Creed are these Assassin's Tombs, where you kind of do some platforming type stuff, and you're trying to find this sarcophagus with a special item that it feeds into this obscure part of the story. But these are really, really fun places to be, these tombs, because what they do is they give the game sort of an enclosed, segregated area to let you run and jump around in. So, you know, most of the time in Assassin's Creed 2, you're out in this big city, and you're running over rooftops, and there are people all over the place that get in your way, and there's guards that you have to look out for. And it's all very integrated. It's an open world kind of deal. And the nice thing about the tombs is that they're very highly designed for getting through, and they actually feel straight out of Prince of Persia. Of course, it's a lot of the same developers, but it's interesting because I think Assassin's Creed, both games, I think, have good controls, and I think it's fun to run around and jump around on things. And, you know, certainly the guys that you're controlling, they move a lot like the Prince of Persia. But in the first game, you're never really asked to do anything with those skills except to climb up to the top of this tower. You know, there's not really any platforming per se. There's some areas where you have to climb a lot, but it's mostly vertical, and you can kind of take it at your own pace, and, you know, there's not a whole lot of skill to it. And these Assassin's Tombs are really sort of platforming playgrounds where, you know, the camera will sweep up. It's literally straight out of Prince of Persia. The camera will sweep up and show you some place way up high on the far side of this giant room that you need to get to. And then it kind of sweeps back over all these different footholds and cross beams and, you know, windows and things that you need to use to get over there. And it's really cool because even though it's mechanically very, very similar to something that you would do in Prince of Persia, the fact is that Assassin's Creed does have some slightly different mechanics, and the style of the platforming is somewhat different. And of course, you don't have the sands of time or anything like that to save you. So it's not that difficult in terms of skill, but the stakes are a little bit higher. And you generally want to think a little bit more before you make a jump. You know, people think of Assassin's Creed as being basically you just hold down a button and run and you climb over whatever's in your way. Well, that's true in the city because it doesn't really matter what you climb over, but when you're in a platforming section and you don't want to fall down, you do actually need to think about what direction you go in, and it's very easy to just jump off into nothing and fall way down and hurt yourself. Or have to retread some ground. So it's really nice, actually, and it makes me appreciate the controls and the mechanics of moving and jumping around in a way that I hadn't before, because now I actually need to use those things and think about how to best put them to work. So that's the main difference. You get a second hidden blade, so you can kill two people at once. The first time I did it, I said out loud, "Whoa." I mean, it's really, really, really cool when you do it, and I didn't even really mean to do it, but when I did it, it's very impressive. But yeah, it's a fun game. I mean, again, I really like the first one, so
yeah, sure.
I'm not finding this to be that much different, but that's okay. But anyway, also, just today got Tatsunoko vs. Capcom, as well as a couple other games, which I'll talk about in the future because I haven't played them yet. I was really excited to get Tatsunoko vs. Capcom. I was really happy they added online play. That was a pretty big selling point for me to get the American version. You know, I'm not that big of a fighting game player, but I do like Smash Brothers, and this is probably the closest thing you can get other than a crappy ripoff like the Ninja Turtles game.
The Turtles game, yeah.
it has great production values. I mean, it's really beautiful. It has lots of crazy characters, and it's just fun to play. You know, the demo back at E3 really impressed me a lot, and when I heard they were adding online, I was like, well, that's probably something I'll get. Mm-hmm. And it plays very well with Classic Controller, which is kind of nice since I just picked up the Pro, so it's a good convergence there as well. And I've played it for a few hours now. I'm finding that there is a bit of a learning curve, and maybe it's because I'm using the more complex control method with the Classic Controller. Because if you use the Wii Remote and Nunchuck, they simplify a lot of things, and it plays more like Smash Brothers.
If you look at the basic layout with a Classic Controller, that in a way has collapsed down what your typical kind of Capcom side-scrolling fighting game, because you've taken away separate kicks and punches and put that down into just three attacks of different strengths.
There's light, medium, and hard attacks, but you still have three attack buttons as opposed
to you've still got three attack buttons and the tag button taking up the Classic Controller face buttons.
Yep.
So it's a nice condensed scheme, but it's still not that different. Whereas, when you go down to like Wii Remote and Nunchuck, or like, I think you can even do Wii Remote on its own, sort of Brawl style. You are really getting down to a kind of Smash Brothers type simplification of the system. But I didn't spend a great deal of time with that because I found the Classic Controller scheme is a real nice fit with the controller. I really like the D-pad on the Classic Controller, especially the Pro. So I didn't really feel the need for a stick, and it just plays really well. It's not too fast, I don't think. I like the fact that it's definitely fast, but it's not ridiculous like kind of some of the versus games
than
in the past.
Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Which is a good thing.
The biggest problem with the game in terms of like playing it on your own is, as Neil kind of pointed out in his review and I pointed out in mine, several months ago of the Japanese one, you've got, these characters to unlock and stuff, but it's literally just play through the arcade mode with a bunch of different characters to unlock more characters. I mean, that is it.
Yeah,
and to be honest, I would rather it just be you unlock certain characters for playing the game in two-player, like for a certain length of time. Mm-hmm. Or at least that would be an alternate method, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, in Brawl, they had all these different optional, ways.
So many of them would be like two ways to do it. Like you could either find it in the Subspace Emissary or, do this challenge or play for this many hours. I think that's a better way to approach it than forcing people to keep playing through the arcade mode to unlock different characters.
Yeah, that reminds me of like Soul Calibur 4 is the same way, where it just forces you, like, oh god, like just so boring playing through the arcade, which you don't care about anyways, to unlock characters that you really don't care about.
It's fun to mess around with the characters, experiment with them. You know, and of course they have these like outrageous super combos and stuff, which is just, you know, you want to see all of them really, because some of them are really funny.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're going to do that, they just didn't incentivize it all that well, unfortunately. And that would be my, with the addition of online players, probably be my only outstanding sort of gripe about it.
Now, have you played online, Johnny?
I tried a couple of matches. They were just random, and the first one, it seemed like we were fairly evenly matched, but I had so much lag on my end, and he didn't seem to have any. So it just felt like I was doing a lot of my moves, and they weren't actually registering, whereas he was just jumping all over the place, going crazy on me.
Yeah.
And then in the second one, I had less lag, but the guy I was playing against was ridiculously good. And
oh,
I just,
nice.
I couldn't even get a hit in on him, and after a while, I was like, well, at this point, you know, I can't really quit out, and I can't pause, and I can't really fight back at all. So I thought, how can I punish this guy?
You just turned it off, didn't you?
No. What I did is I just stopped moving. I just stopped doing
there
anything.
You go.
Are you trolling?
Well,
Tatsunoko versus Capcom.
It's more of a sit-in. It's more of civil disobedience.
Passive resistance.
Yeah, yeah.
That's horrible, Johnny. That's terrible.
Well, I mean, it's like if I just keep running at him, I'm not going to be able to get a punch in on him. So it's fun. It's more amusing to me to just sit there and watch him freak out because he's not sure what's going on. It was clearly unsettling him because he's fidgeting, but he didn't just run at me. He wanted me to do something. You know, he's not a turtle player, but kind of a reactive kind of a player. And he's not the kind to just jump at you and start kicking you. You know, mm-hmm. like he waits to see what you're doing. And so my response is to do nothing. And it was
quite
actually,
zen, actually.
We both stood there for like 15 seconds at one point, not moving. And I guarantee I was enjoying that moment a lot more than he was. So
how long before he decided he had enough of this and just took you out?
It happened eventually, but you know that was just my shining moment. That was the only thing I could do to him. So,
do you think that's a good argument for not having Wii speaking then?
I don't know. I was disappointed with the player matching because it was an unranked battle, but I thought I would still get matched up against someone with a low number of matches played or something like that. And this guy...
Well, but I mean, the thing is with that, though, he could hypothetically be someone like me in the sense that he bought the game, the Japanese version, and is now buying it again to play it online. But not like me in the sense that he might actually be good at the game.
Yeah, no, it showed his stats, and he was out of my league, and I knew that before the match even started.
Yeah.
Right. So, well, you knew what he was in for.
Yeah, I was disappointed in the in the matchup.
You went in, and you were proven correct.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to playing it against, you know, people from the forums, real people, and I'll continue to try the random matching and see if I can find someone. And I'm also a little concerned about the lag that I saw, but hopefully that'll sometimes
yeah,
be better.
I mean, it could well be another brawl type situation with you know, the geographics coming into to play.
Yeah.
Well, but see, if it's like Brawl, maybe they can have the whole system where even if you lose connection, you don't realize you're not playing a human anymore.
I have to say, I am impressed with Capcom, you know, bringing over games and then actually adding stuff to them. That's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're adding Wii Speak to Monster Hunter Tri.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually made me more interested in that game, although...
Just so you can justify your purchase of a Wii Speak.
No, it's not that. I mean, it's just, you know, if I was going to buy that game and play it online, it would have to have Wii Speak.
That's exactly it. I mean, it does really make that game better, much better.
It doesn't necessarily mean that I will buy that game. I've still never played Monster Hunter, and so I'm a little concerned that I might hate it.
You have to understand that game without Wii Speak would be incredibly annoying. I mean, because to play in like the four-player party on the PSP, all they have is, I think that you map phrases to, I think, your directional pad.
Yeah.
It sucks.
Oh,
I mean,
it's that. Oh, I hate that.
I mean, it is an RPG where you're supposed to be cooperating with these people and you're trading items back and forth and, you know, you're supposed to be formulating some kind of strategy here. Like, how can you do that without voice chat?
Exactly. I mean, you're fighting these monsters in real time, and you actually have to coordinate attacks in real time. So,
yeah.
How people do that just with, you know, mapped phrases. I have no idea. There must be a lot of chat going on offline. I don't know how that's done, but...
But the fact is, the Wii Speak is such a useless device that, I mean, it's nowhere near your face, so it's questionable quality to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you're actually going to get anything out of it, or get just like...
It depends a lot on how you set it up. It has to do with how far that you put the microphone from your TV speakers, how close you put it to your body. It does actually work better when you pull the... And the microphone has a really long cord on it.
It does, but I don't have a really long table.
Okay, yeah. Well, anyway, I mean, if you can pull the mic up closer to you, that makes a huge difference. It really does.
Yeah, and I guess, like, if you've got... I've got wireless headphones to what, you know, to use with my TV.
Oh, that helps
so
a lot.
So that's going to cut out on the echo issue, because that's really pronounced.
Like, yeah, it is.
That helps a lot, too. I did that with the conduit.
Playing the conduit with Johnny and John, and you can hear John's music echoing in the background.
Mm-hmm. But that's
all you could hear. I was like, John! John! All I could hear was just the background music. I'm like, well, fuck this.
Turn down the ice cube.
I actually meant the game, the music from the game on your TV.
Either or.
John, like, you know, super computer hacker, just put in SD music support for his own
game. I just added it myself. I got tired of not having it.
Just so he could get dropped from the game while listening to Cube.
I would still be playing The Conduit if you could just pipe in your own music.
Well, last weekend I did also finish Uncharted 2, and won't say much about it, but that's a very good game. I'm not sure that I am as impressed with it as a lot of other people are. And again, maybe it's just because I really like the first Uncharted, and the sequel doesn't feel really that much different to me.
Yeah, I agree with that.
All the things that I liked about the first one are still done really well in the second one, and it's a bit less annoying in some respects, but...
I mean, I almost feel like it got so much props just because people actually played it.
Yeah, that's probably a lot to do with it.
Like, I felt that nobody played the first game, and everybody was turned off. I mean, everybody... I know that a lot of the people in our forums, they got it off of PSN, played whatever, like, the one level they had, and they didn't like it at all.
Oh, the demo, yeah.
Was it a really shit demo?
Yeah, apparently.
And
I can see
that. I talked
that.
About it on the show once.
They just put up a demo for the second one, actually. I've downloaded it and played it, yeah.
Yeah, Greg, I think you'll like that game. I think you'll like it. It can be frustrating in certain parts. It's a case of, you know, the game wants you to do things a very certain way sometimes, and it tries to show you what it wants you to do through various means, some subtle and some not. But sometimes it just, the message doesn't get across, and it's like, where do you want me to go? What do you want me to do?
I mean,
it's just one of those games where I say that to the game all the time. It's like, come on, man, what do you want? I'll do it.
I feel like that kind of game really needs to be clear about what it wants you to do.
I've got this image in my mind of Johnny as Boris from the end of GoldenEye. Speak to me!
Well, it's funny because you mentioned GoldenEye, and I was thinking about that first 007 GameCube game where it was just like, there was stuff that you could do, and it would just zoom the camera in on it and show it to you completely out of context. Just like, here is an explosive barrel while your characters are talking. It's like, gee, I wonder what I'm supposed to do here.
Yeah, Uncharted's not that overt, usually, but there are definitely exploding barrels and people talking.
Mm-hmm.
Usually not at the same time. But, the game has a lot of amazing moments. Overall, I still think the shooting is not really as tight as it should be considering how much there is of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of times, and it was a lot worse in the first Uncharted, but even in 2, there were a lot of times where I'd walk into a big environment with guns lying around where you're clearly about to start a giant battle in 5 or 10 seconds. And I just kind of get this sinking feeling like, man, I just got out of a big gunfight. I really don't want to jump into another one right now. You know, so... Sometimes I just feel like it's still a bit too much. I still think the platforming, the climbing around stuff, the Tomb Raider kind of elements, I still think they're more fun. And there's plenty of it in Uncharted 2. I just wish it was balanced a little more towards that, because the gunplay still isn't quite good enough for me in a lot of cases. But anyway, that's all I've got for new business, and now we're going to take a break. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. this week on Nintendo World Report, we've got an interview with InSpace. It's actually part one of the interview with Dan O'Leary. It's a very interesting interview. He talks about how InSpace started, how it survived as a company, what it's like making Call of Duty games for DS, and why gamers hate licensed games. And in part two, he's going to be talking about Geist and some other stuff.
Actually, it's not Dan. It's going to be somebody. It's going to be another person from InSpace. But
it will be
equally as interesting. It was so big of an interview that we couldn't fit it into one. So there you go.
There you go. And then we also have some impressions from Jared on Tournament of Legends, which is actually the new name for Gladiator AD. The legendary sort of fighting game by High
Stomp
Voltage
on his balls. 4.5 minutes.
Yes. The game is now rated T, so I think they've taken a lot of that kind of stuff out.
All right, now Neil Ronahan reviews Tatsunoko vs. Capcom. He really liked it, saying that it was accessible and right up there with Brawl. He had a few minor complaints, but you'll have to read it for yourself to see what they were. I reviewed Tatsunoko vs. Capcom over a year ago now when it came out in Japan. Neil and I are very much in agreement on this. It is really quite accessible for a sort of traditional fighting game and gloriously over the top. Great fun.
Yeah.
And on the impressions front, Andy has impressions of Ace Attorney Investigations' Miles Edgeworth, which he says retains the gameplay that made Phoenix Wright famous with a new interface.
And you can actually play that same demo for yourself on the Nintendo channel.
Yes.
On the review front, Matt Blunden reviewed DSiWare title Me and My Dogs, Friends Forever. And as you can probably surmise, it's, one might say, an homage to Nintendogs.
But it's downloadable and it's like $8, right?
Yeah.
I'm surprised the title isn't Friends, the number 4, and then ever.
Well, I'm surprised it's not Friends with a Z either.
Friends.
Or Z for Greg's benefit. Pedro Hernandez also reviewed The Magic Obelisk. It's a puzzle platformer. He said it's very unique, but it's also very difficult. He cited some tough control issues, and I think there's kind of some pathing issues. If you want a challenge, go for it, but those who don't might want to stay away.
Magic Obelisk by the developers of Super Smash Bros. Brawl.
Yeah, minus the direction of the talent. So we have an interview with the Revolution team that did a translation of Fatal Frame 4. It's a detailed and interesting interview about the process of creating it.
It's a very in-depth interview. They gave us some really good responses, so you want to check it out.
We also have Jared's impressions of Sonic and Sega All-Stars Racing, which plays very much like Mario Kart, but the graphics suck.
All right, well, that's what's going on at the website. Hope you'll check out NintendoWorldReport.com. We are back, and it's time once again for the Games of the Decade feature. And at this point, I'm going to turn over to Greg to explain where we are in this process.
Yep, so we're nearing the end now. We've got a trio of games this week to commend to you for consideration. But next week, we're going to be having the final round of submissions. And then after that is when the four of us are going to have to look at the whole list as they've accumulated over the past several weeks. And then identify our own individual shortlists of what we think should be put forward to the users of the site for the poll of 5 games. So we're going to have to narrow this big list of about 20 games down to 5. And then we'll have to hash it out amongst ourselves as to what the 5 should actually be. Johnny is going to be invested with the ultimate power on that in the end. if the law needs to be laid down, if consensus cannot be reached, then there's going to have to be executive decision made by Johnny, but let's hope it doesn't come to that.
Right.
That's going to be next week. That's going to be kind of the conclusion to this feature. But for now, we're going to roll on with the next round of submissions. So the first one is from Johnny, and it's for Eternal Darkness.
Really, Eternal Darkness is kind of everything that normal Nintendo games are not. It's very serious, legitimately scary in some parts. It's very chatty, you know, with a lot of dialogue, a lot of in-depth writing, and it's really a truly mature game. In fact, I think one of the very few mature games that exists, currently. It did a lot of very innovative things. Eternal Darkness has multiple playable characters, and some of them actually die while you're playing as them. At the time, it was incredibly shocking, and it's still something that you don't see very often, but it has been replicated in such very popular games as Modern Warfare 1 and 2. It also has the famous insanity effects, which are not only really cool and very interesting, but also revolutionary. They really kind of change the dynamic between how you play a game, between the player and the game. And sometimes it feels like the game is playing tricks on you. I mean, you see something like this being very influential on recent games like Batman Arkham Asylum with the Scarecrow sequences, as well as Silent Hill Shattered Memories. You know, Eternal Darkness is full of this really cool lore. It's sort of loosely based on H.P. Lovecraft stuff, but you have demons, you have magic, you have all these glyphs, and really weird, you know, history-changing stuff that is pretty cool territory, and it's something that you don't see in gaming all that often, so it really has a different feel than most other games. And despite Eternal Darkness being very different from what you'd expect from Nintendo, it is still very much a Nintendo game in some key ways. I mean, it has great controls, it has really interesting puzzles, although sometimes simple, and the whole game just has a great feel of polish on it that is really missing from the later Silicon Knights games, which were not produced with Nintendo quite as closely, if at all. In closing, I think really the best thing you can say about Eternal Darkness is Nintendo oftentimes partners with third-party developers or indie developers to create games that Nintendo has made in the past, or they could make themselves, but they just don't want to, or maybe they want to do it for less money, or they want to put some kind of little twist on it that only an outside company could do. I think Eternal Darkness is a game that Nintendo could never and would never make for themselves, and so it's really a pretty amazing partnership between Nintendo and another company joining together and creating something really interesting that still feels like a Nintendo game, but it feels different also. For all those reasons, I think Eternal Darkness is an amazing game. It holds up extremely well today, and again, very influential on a lot of things that have come after it. The next Game of the Decade nominee is going to be The Legend of Zelda Wind Waker. Zach Miller is covering this one.
The Legend of Zelda The Wind Waker completely changed my perception of art direction in games. Until that point, my thinking had been that game graphics existed in a sort of Darwinian, unidirectional progression from Pac-Man to, at the time, Dead or Alive Extreme Beach Volleyball. Photorealism had always been the goal, right? Wind Waker single-handedly shattered that concept in my mind. Its aesthetic is not handcuffed to some abstract concept of realism. It exists in its own striking, vibrant, consistent animated realm. Dismissing the Wind Waker as Zelda is to miss the point entirely. I would argue that it is the most beautiful Zelda game ever released, thanks to wonderfully consistent art direction and the wise decision to stylize the graphics rather than shoot for a realistic look that the GameCube would simply not support. Ocarina of Time moved in the direction of realism, but I would argue that Twilight Princess struggles with it. But Wind Waker sits apart from them, existing in its own fully realized world. Wind Waker also brings a deeper story and a palpable mythos to the table, really for the first time in a Zelda game. It opens with, for all intents and purposes, a creation myth, how the world came to be as it is today. Throughout the game, the hero learns of the world as it was before, how it came to be destroyed, and his inevitable place in history. There are so many jaw-dropping moments in the game that relate to this grand story. The first time you travel to the world beneath the waves, for example, or when your friends in the overworld are called to their higher purposes. Nothing, though, beats the villain's perhaps justifiable motivations for his deeds and the final blow in the ensuing battle. I could discuss the game's main components, but to me those are all secondary. I will touch on the often demonized sailing, though. The player travels the expansive Great Sea on a sailboat. Many people complain that sailing is boring and takes up too much of the game. I disagree, and would suggest that the distance between islands is vital to the game's sense of scale and the deep, engaging feeling of adventure and discovery that this game revels in. The Legend of Zelda The Wind Waker is as much an experience as a game to be played, if not more so. For all its artistic strengths and grandeur, I wholeheartedly nominate this epic GameCube game as the game of the decade.
All right, very strong case there. And finally for this week, we've got Perfect Dark, as submitted by our own John Lindemann.
Perfect Dark was a spiritual successor to GoldenEye 007, a seminal console first-person shooter and one of the best games of all time. Perfect Dark took everything that Rare had built in GoldenEye 007 and upped the ante across the board. It is an incredibly robust package that even exceeds most console first-person shooters today. It has a 17-level story mode, as well as a co-op story mode that lets you play through the single player with a friend, and a unique counter-op mode in which a friend plays against you. On the multiplayer side, Perfect Dark features four-player local multiplayer with a multitude of game styles, such as Deathmatch, Capture the Flag, Survival, King of the Hill, and Hacker. One of the most unique things about its multiplayer mode, however, was the fact that it allowed players to assign up to 8 bots so that they could have 12-player death matches if they so desire. In a time when there was no such thing as Xbox Live, the ability to have 12-player death matches in any capacity was very unique and incredibly forward-thinking on Rare's part. In addition to all of these features, there were also unlockables from GoldenEye 007, as well as several levels of difficulty to challenge even the best player. Perfect Dark certainly pushed the N64 to its technical limits, as it was one of the few games released to use the RAM pack. It was actually probably too technically ambitious for the hardware that it was on, as some critics cited the frame rate that dipped precipitously low in some areas. Despite these small issues, Perfect Dark was critically acclaimed, with a Metacritic average of 97, which is second best on the N64 behind Ocarina of Time. Perfect Dark also spawned a franchise, with a Game Boy Color game and also an Xbox 360 launch title to its credit. And to prove the fact that it's still relevant, one of the most anticipated upcoming games on Xbox Live Arcade is a retooled 1080p version of Perfect Dark. All of these factors combine to prove that Perfect Dark is certainly a worthy contender for Game of the Decade.
Nice. Yeah, Perfect Dark's probably one that could easily be overlooked. Again, it came out in 2000, so it's one of the older ones that we have.
Mm-hmm.
I think Perfect Dark is... I think when people go back and play it on Xbox Live Arcade soon, they're going to remember how revolutionary that was at the time and how amazing it was.
Well, I mean, as John pointed out, the ambitiousness of the feature set is pretty ridiculous. I forgot about the whole counter-op thing switching around different enemies, kind of like a Agent Smith style, just type thing. That was pretty cool as well. I mean, so ambitious and overreached a little bit. But the main thing I'll always remember is how much fun the multiplayer was because of the bots.
Yeah,
the bots
yeah.
just made it a lot more fun. I mean, I'm sure a lot of our listeners have got very, very fond memories of playing GoldenEye. You know, it was such a huge thing. So many people apparently played the multiplayer of that and had loads of fun with it. But Perfect Dark is a lot more fun.
It's a better game.
The features are so much more rich. Stuff like the secondary functions on the guns, like the laptop gun, is great for, some of these more scenario kind of modes, like capture the case or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It added a lot to that sort of thing. And the bots, you could do individual things, like set their behaviors, tell them to go after certain other players, specific other players. To kill them in particular, and it was really incredibly ambitious and just so much fun.
It also had all those challenges with you. I think they were called simulations, but
yeah.
you would fight against the bots to unlock things, and that's pretty much just ripped off in Smash Brothers Melee and Brawl as a defense.
When I think about Perfect Dark, I just think that it did pretty much everything that you could do without being online in terms of a first-person shooter.
Mm-hmm.
There's really nothing else I could think that you could add to it.
I mean, it's funny because even now people wanted to go play GoldenEye if the N64 was out, but I basically don't let them. I basically say, nope, we're not playing that.
Yeah.
We're going to play Perfect Dark instead because it's better.
It is so much better. I mean,
and they get upset, but deep down they know it's true. They know it's a better game.
Oh, yeah. You got some of the cool weapons as well, you had the Farsight thing that shoots through walls.
No, that's not a cool weapon. That's evil.
That's more cool in concept than it is in execution.
execution being the correct word.
I like the fly-by-wire rockets where you could pilot them through through the levels and take someone out. That's pretty fun.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many hours I spent in the gun range in that game. Just trying to get all the challenges in there.
Yeah. I think the most fun I ever had with that game was I had 3 friends, and we basically said, all right, we're going to fill the world with Dark Sims, which is this super evil AI.
Yeah.
It's still some of the best hunter-killer AI I think I've ever seen.
It's inhuman. It's actually faster than
it is.
Humans.
Yeah, and we basically just said, we're going to fill it with Dark Sims, and we're going to see how long we can survive. And the answer was not very long. I mean, they just... we got in a corner together and we're like, all right, we'll protect each other. It didn't matter.
Left 4 Dead.
Yeah, they just completely wiped us out. And it is. It's kind of like Left 4 Dead. It's how long can we pull this shit together? And
yeah.
We got taken out with like a rocket.
Let's see, with all the different maps and the different weapons and the bots and all that, you could configure so many different kinds of matches to mess around with. It definitely had a lot more appeal than the GoldenEye multiplayer.
I mean, yeah, you could basically make a different game with all the configurations.
Yep.
Because, yeah, I mean, basically what I just described is kind of like Left 4 Dead. I mean, I made a survival game out of a first-person shooter.
Yeah, you can almost mod it. You know, there's so much to do. Well, it seems like the pattern every week is that we play 3 or 4 clips, and then we talk a lot about the last one just because it's in proximity. But
I would like to talk about Wind Waker a little bit.
Well, I was just going to say, James, I mean, that's not on purpose that we end up talking about these so much. But next week, we're going to talk about all of these. We're going to have a pretty big to-do about it. So we'll have 3 or 4 final games next week to round out the list, and then we're going to start going through and we'll catch up on a lot of these that it may seem like we've kind of glazed over them. It's just that was the goal, was to glaze over all of them, and we can't resist when it comes to games like this.
Yeah, well, Perfect Dark is, you know, like, it's a certain sort of communal kind of aspect to that, because if anyone who did play it has always got fun stories to trade. Like,
yeah.
A single-player game, not so much.
No.
Yeah, it's okay.
It is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I did want to pick, just before we finish off, I did want to pick, definitely with the Batman and Insanity Effect stuff, that's like a pretty explicit nod to Eternal Darkness at one point.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of it in Silent Hill as well.
At first, it's screwing with you in the context of the story, and then it goes all fourth wall breaky on you, which is just straight out of Eternal Darkness.
Oh yeah, like your save card has been corrupted.
It's in that kind of ballpark, and yeah, that I think it's definitely worth pointing out that that's a good example of a very fine game that's influenced.
All right, well, we'll have more to say about Wind Waker and several other Zelda games next week, as well as all these other Game of the Decade nominees, so look forward to that, please. All right, it's time for listener mail, and let's see, James, you're up first.
So, Tom from Rochester, New York writes, I was just reading an article today about everyone's recommendation selection titles that just came out in Japan. There are the 7 games that are being repackaged and discounted in price, similar to what Player's Choice used to be. My question is, do you think we'll see Player's Choice in the US now that these titles are being released in Japan? If so, what games do you think would make the lineup, and what would the sale price be?
I mean, I guess you could start off by looking closely at what this selection is in Japan. So, first of all, is Player's Choice in the sense of recommendations on the Nintendo channel in Japan?
Because I was about to say, that name doesn't make any sense at all. Everyone's a recommendation selection.
Yeah, obviously it's translation issues and that, but it's because it's called Everyone's Nintendo channel in Japan.
Right, yeah.
It's not called Nintendo, it's called Everyone's Nintendo channel. Yeah. It's kind of tying into that. But yeah, so it's based on, like, they have different strata of, like, how well a game's been recommended on the Nintendo channel. So it's like gold, silver, bronze. You know, and so these games were got into the gold and silver categories, I think, and they're third-party games, you know, that are getting the cut price here, which is about the equivalent of $30, 2,800 yen.
So, that's what I would expect.
So you've got
as
stuff like Muramasa, 428, which is the sort of text adventure type thing from Sega that got a perfect score in Famitsu, you know. So they're kind of, I think maybe one of the ski and snowboard games from Namco. Yeah, quite a disparate bunch of games, but apparently that are well-liked by the people that played them. So applying a similar model to America, it seems like a nice way to try and maybe broaden the horizons in terms of, you know, maybe getting people to think about purchasing non-Nintendo games.
It's tricky in the U.S. because we've had a little more price variability for new games than Japan has, I think. So when you think about something like a game that I would love to be on the Player's Choice for Wii in the U.S. would be like Zack and Wiki from Capcom.
Yeah.
And, you know, I bought that game brand new for $20. You might even get it for less now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's...
you can get it for $10 now.
It's already...
Right, so does it make sense to re-release it at $30?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I guess the only basis is just that it's some sort of relaunch, like, you know, because
right.
if these all had, like, common packaging or something, it kind of ties it all together. But yeah, it's a bit loose. I mean, that's the thing. The pricing dynamics in Japan are quite different. Like, for instance, it seems to me that in terms of when games come out, you know, their opening recommended retail price, there's actually more variation. Yeah, you get some pretty interesting variations in terms of, you know, like, you know, Sin of Punishment might cost one thing, but then, like, the PokePart Wii will cost 2,000 yen less than that. And, you know, they kind of, you know, they have some that kind of open at about the equivalent of $70, and then others that are closer to 50, and all, it kind of, it varies quite a lot. But of course, the secondhand market, the rental market, all this is not in existence in nearly the same way in Japan. Rental's banned and all that kind of stuff. So, right. you know, there's a lesser propensity for the games to get severely kind of discounted, I think.
Well, yeah, I think the main advantage to doing this program in the West would be not so much to offer games at a lower price than you could already get them, because I think most of the games that would be considered, you can probably already get at a pretty low price. I think the main thing would be to reprint them. You know, to get more copies out there, and like you said, to put them in a little bit different packaging to get people's attention and raise awareness of them. And I'm sure the third parties would be pretty eager for this, because it's very low cost for them to reprint a game that's already been out there. And especially, you know, the nice thing about Player's Choice is that it's a program run by Nintendo, so basically they're getting marketing from Nintendo for these games, probably more marketing than the third parties themselves gave to some of these games in the first place.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, also, it might just raise awareness of the Nintendo channel to some extent. Like, if you buy this game that's been recommended via the Nintendo channel, then people might actually say, oh, you know, what is this? And actually look into it a bit more, certain parts of the market anyway. So I guess it could be a nice element of complementarity there. But I guess what would be analogous in the Western market to things like Muramasa and 428, in like bit niche-ish, but the people
Geometry
like
Wars Galaxies.
Yeah, well, yeah, that was a budget title to start with, wasn't it? But yeah, that's
excellent. But it needs to be. I think a re-release would do it a lot of good. I think there are a lot of, you know, newer Wii owners who don't even know that game exists.
Yeah, it was a long time ago now, really, wasn't it?
I mean, it was, and that's still one of my favorite games on the system. I think a lot more people should be playing Geometry Wars Galaxy. I just picked it up for a couple hours this week. I wanted to test it out with my Classic Pro, and ended up playing it for over 2 hours. Just couldn't put it down, you know.
I mean, Zach and Wiki, I would think could have a shot at being, you know, because I mean I think it's fantastic. It's one of my favorite Wii games.
Yeah, Zach and Wiki. Also, another one that just off the top of my head was that pinball collection. The Williams Pinball Collection?
Yeah, that is legitimately a very good pinball game.
So, but really, it's not going to be... You're all basically saying it's not going to be anything that's really big, singular, core title.
I can't see them doing anything like that. You know, you look at what Nintendo's doing with their own titles, which are the biggest sellers on the system, right? And they've got these, you know, this evergreen, you know, it's a huge part of Nintendo's approach, and they don't want to get into this paradigm of, you know, the inexorable fall of price.
Yeah, why would they price cut Mario Kart?
So Mario Kart never coming down, or even some of the lower tier stuff. It's just that isn't happening. They're not going to get into that.
Remember Melee on GameCube was full price for 3 years after it came
out.
Well,
see, here's what I could see them doing, though. I could see them rebranding some games as Player's Choice, but still charging $50 for them.
Yeah, maybe first-party stuff, but they don't really need to do that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, first-party. I could see them putting labels on there to attract more casual fans. This game sold a lot.
From the point of view of reprinting, like, there are some first-party games that have gone out of print, like, yeah, Battalion Wars or, like,
Metroid Prime.
might be. Yeah. But in general, no. I mean, I think you probably are better off, you know, doing it with some of these kind of these lesser-known titles, because it's very discreet from Nintendo's area of the software market on Wii, and so it doesn't impinge on the kind of price environment that they want to cultivate with their own games.
Yeah, I think Nintendo of America and of Europe would be smart to do this. It's a matter of implementation, like I said. I'm not sure if you want to do it an across the board price, or maybe some of them are 20, some of them are 30, something like that. But, you know, as far as the selection goes, the Nintendo channel is probably a decent way to do it. I haven't looked at the U.S. Nintendo channel to see what are the most highly recommended games, but usually when I do go look at those, I'm pretty much in agreement with, you know, the games that get silver and gold and platinum. It seems like the collective, at least the people who actually bother to recommend games on the Nintendo channel, they seem to be pretty smart about it. And a lot of times, you know, a game that I really like that's not that well known, something like Wario Land on Wii, it has a really good rating on the Nintendo channel, even though not that many people played it. So, I mean, if you go by that kind of, if that's your criterion, then I think you could probably find several third-party games that are actually really good and would deserve to be put on this list.
I just feel like Nintendo wouldn't follow the Japanese model here.
No, I mean, they certainly don't have to. I mean, as we've mentioned before, there's a sort of quite a significant divergence between the regional entities in many respects. So the fact that this is going on in Japan is by no means a sort of very strong indicator that it's going to happen elsewhere.
This is a what if.
Yeah.
Well, a couple other games you could throw on there, Mad World from Sega. I think No More Heroes, the original, would probably be pretty smart, especially since the sequel's out now.
In the future, you could maybe look at something like A Boy and His Blob, but it's a bit young at the minute, but you know, that would be in the ballpark, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for the question there, Tom. And John has the next question.
Marty from Ireland writes, with 2010 upon us, there are now various most anticipated games lists being made. When thinking about my own most anticipated Wii titles of 2010, I realized that despite it being my favorite franchise, Metroid Other M has not piqued my interest for Samus's Next Adventure. Maybe it's because I've never found Team Ninja's games particularly appealing, or that the gameplay trailer shown at E3 seemed to be more about killing enemies in cinematic ways than about immersive atmosphere or exploration. What are your feelings towards Other M, and do you think this will be a good move for the franchise, or its death knell?
Well, first off, I want to say the trailer from last E3, not necessarily a gameplay trailer. Mm-hmm. There's some parts in there that look like they might be gameplay, but most of it certainly is not.
No.
So I don't think you can rely too heavily on that being some kind of accurate depiction of what the game looks like.
Furthermore, I mean, it's a trailer, you know, I mean, we talk about cinematic, cinematic, I mean, that's what you've got to put in there, because it's like, oh, you're wandering around and it's all moody.
Here's Samus in a dark
You can't do that in something where you're cutting between, like, crazy stuff going on that's all supposed to overwhelm you.
You guys remember the early trailers for Metroid Prime were pretty disconcerting, I think, because, you know, it was mostly stuff, it was mostly third-person stuff with Samus running around, and they were basically, there were cutscenes, or there was something from the opening movie in the game, or
it was
like
concepts, like stuff, really.
Right.
I mean, like, because
I
think that was probably a lot earlier relative to the game's development process than what we're seeing.
There was like
Ram,
2 seconds of some first-person stuff, and, you know, it's just, it's not always easy to tell from a trailer like that. I mean, that's basically a teaser.
But in short, I mean, the trailer doesn't really worry me in itself. I mean, I haven't really got history in Team Ninja's games besides the DS Ninja Gaiden game, which was all right. You know, nothing special, I suppose. But I'm not too worried. You know, I know that some of the old R&D1 guys, you know, like Sakamoto himself, the director of Super Metroid, is, you know, heavily involved. So it's an issue, but I think hopefully, you know, it's a case of those guys kind of wrangling Team Ninja's kind of development horsepower into the, into the right direction. What I am more worried about is some of the stuff they've talked about, you know, with really, really emphasizing the story and Samus's character. And
Yeah. I'm worried about cutscenes galore. That's what I'm kind of worried about.
Yeah, I'm not really that on board with that.
I don't know. I don't feel like that's going to be a major issue. Because
hopefully, yeah. I mean, it's one of these things, like, you know, if it's just, I mean, I didn't really have a big issue with it in Fusion. I mean, in terms of the amount of dialogue in that game, it wasn't something I particularly enjoyed about it, but at the same time, it didn't spoil my experience of the game terribly much either. So it could well be a similar sort of thing.
Fusion has problems beyond the story.
Yeah, I would probably cite other things about Fusion in terms of my experience than just the amount of text. But, I mean, with this, it's a question of how much is it going to kind of affect the gameplay, this emphasis on story and character and showing Samus's tender side or whatever the hell Sakamoto said recently.
I don't really know if I want to see that. You know?
The phrase they used was her emotional side.
Emotional side.
Yeah.
But, I mean, but if you think about it, she took this line of work because she wants to kill people.
I mean, I thought he's just supposed to bring him in. I mean, you know.
Well, no, but what I'm saying
is, how many murder beasts his dog up on?
There is. I mean, there's obviously some kind of emotional element to the fact that she's crazy.
But I mean, almost like part of me doesn't even want to know that, though.
Yeah, I don't think it matters.
I don't really need to know. Like, you know, I kind of like that whole sort of Clint Eastwood sort of, you don't know, kind of the mysterious sort of, you know, I kind of like that sort of stuff.
I know what you mean. I mean, I guess there's an argument to say, well, they've done that, so, you know, what else do you want to do? How much longer do you want to do it? But my only concern is just, you know, I'm perfectly willing to think that I might not particularly like it, but it ultimately the story parts are going to be incidental, and if the game, you know, delivers where it needs to deliver, then it isn't going to matter. My only concern is if the cutscenes are too long or it's too much of the emphasis that it will actually detract from the gameplay experience. That's my only worry. I'm kind of, you know, it's very unlikely I'm going to watch the story and go, oh, wow, this is really worth it. Because I'm generally not a story guy, and the chances of this being narratively effective are not that good.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think we'll probably know all of this when we have the GDC press conference. I think that's actually going to be...
It seems like it's very much on course for that time window that we talked about at the beginning of the year for, like, August in America, because they've already pigeonholed it for summer release in Japan. You've got the GDC panel that Sakamoto's doing.
Teaser site's up,
so...
And the teaser site is a linchpin of Japanese gaming culture.
That's right.
When the teaser site goes up, you know that game is real, and it's coming out pretty soon.
Start the clock, basically.
Especially if you have the 3-week countdown clock.
If you looked at the teaser site, did it make anyone else think they were trying to evoke Blade Runner?
A little bit. The
lonely piano music can remind me of when Deckard's messing around with the piano, and, you know, these sort of soft golden skies, a bit like the view from the Tyrell building. They've never really been shy about their sci-fi influences. Ridley, anyone?
I was looking at Sakamoto's description for his panel. God, dude's done everything.
Yeah, no, he's like one of the secret weapons at Nintendo.
I knew he was everywhere, but
all types of games too. All types of games.
Well, obviously, WarioWare is one of his most famous, you know, sort of newer creations. But the game with Miis on DS, which is sort of like The Sims from everything I've gathered.
Dude is everywhere,
which is so far away from Metroid.
God.
He's versatile.
You know, of course, he has been squarely positioned in the portable scene for several years. So, obviously it's Team Ninja that are delivering the development bandwidth, but I'm so interested to see, in gameplay terms, what he could do on that bigger canvas of a console game.
I'm actually kind of disappointed they're probably going to use this as a Metroid platform, because it's only 60 minutes, and I feel like he could give one hell of a GDC speech.
It depends how much of it is actually a GDC thing and how much of it is a promotional tool.
I would say
James, the current information that we have about the panel is that it's not really focused on Metroid.
No, but I mean, it's obviously timed that it's going to come up, and they're going to spend a fair amount of time
hopefully.
On it.
I think it's a good time, it's a good place to, because that's, you know, GDC is a show that really gamers pay attention to.
Right.
It's a good time to announce a game like Metroid. That's really the audience who
cares. And they've also announced Gears of War there, like, twice, I mean, which is pretty damn mainstream.
But see, I mean, I just feel like he could give a really interesting presentation that was argued at, you know, developers, which is what GDC is.
I know. Well, I hope we'll see that, but I also want juicy other M tidbits.
That would be fantastic. I mean, with that much diversity under his belt and projects.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure he'll be giving the talk through a translator, which means there's only so much real information he's going to get.
Yeah.
You know, in a 1-hour panel or something.
You don't
want to
overwhelm the translator, and you can only say so much because you have to wait for him to finish.
So, my feelings towards Other M, I'm pretty much with Greg. I'm less concerned with the story because that's pretty easy for me to ignore if it's done badly. I mean, I think you could get to emotional depths of Samus's character using the template of the previous games. I mean, I think, you know, when Samus finds the Metroid hatchling at the end of Metroid 2 and then essentially takes care of it, sort of, up through the beginning of Super Metroid and develops this weird, you know, interspecies kind of attachment, emotional attachment. All that's done pretty much without dialogue and with really very little on-screen time even. And I just think Samus is the kind of character who you understand her personality through the things that she does, through actions. And yeah, to me, you don't need a whole lot of writing to supplement that, you know, or you shouldn't. So, again, I'm with Greg. Like, I don't care that much about her backstory, where she comes from. I mean, they had the comics in Nintendo Power were good, but the stuff in Zero Mission towards the end, that was just fine, really, and had pretty much the same effect in a much simpler way. So I'd prefer that they stuck with that kind of storytelling.
Yeah, I just want them to keep it simple. I don't want something like a love interest or anything like that. I mean, that would just...
I don't think that's going to
happen.
It's
so predictable. I just hope they don't do that. I mean, it was awful in Gears of War 2. Just don't do it here. Thank you.
Not unless it's a chick, right, James?
Oh,
no, no. I was thinking that I think they've pretty much probed the depth of her interactions with others in
Prime 3.
Well, I mean, they implied that she's not like, she doesn't hate every single living creature, you know? She actually has peers that she respects.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably as far as they would take that.
And she does whatever other people tell her.
I think she's going to talk. In Prime 3, everyone else talks, but she doesn't. Whereas
right.
I think she's going to talk in this one from the teaser site. There's a little sentence of her speaking, so...
And she kind of talks in Fusion.
No,
you know,
she extensively at times,
in,
yeah.
In text,
soliloquies.
Yes.
Yeah.
She's verbose, yeah. She's a writer.
I just like the image of her delivering soliloquies.
Not as chatty as the computer, probably, but...
yeah.
Well, I mean, she does kind of talk in Prime 3, and it's mostly nonverbal how she assents to what other people are saying or how she reacts to them. But it's she's pretty quiet in that. Everybody else won't shut the hell up.
Yeah. But I guess I'm with Greg. Like, I can easily ignore a bad story. It'll be disappointing if that's the way it goes down, but I'm okay with that. I guess I'm more concerned about the gameplay and how that translates to whatever they're doing with it, because you've got a new developer working on it. You've got Sakamoto. It sounds like he's a lot more directly involved in this than he was with the Prime games.
Definitely. Yeah.
And like Greg said, he hasn't really made a console game in quite a while. But then again, he was pretty heavily involved with Zero Mission, which, you know, that's pretty much my favorite Metroid.
Well,
so.
And I mean, it's not a big jump from a 2D handheld Metroid to a 2D console Metroid. I mean,
well, if that's what it is.
But the question that it remains: how much of these other elements, like that we've seen suggested, like some first person shooting, some arena battling,
mm-hmm.
how much are these going to be? It's still such an open question.
As you said,
you know, those out of context snippets in the trailer aren't very informative about what the final experience is going to be.
I wouldn't anticipate a lot of that.
No, I would anticipate being associated with boss battles, personally, but it's totally speculative at this point, because we don't know.
I'm a little concerned about motion controls, because...
I hope they don't force it.
I'm afraid they're going to shove some motion controls in there.
It's going to be motion plus. Everything is motion plus.
I really doubt it'll be motion plus.
It's going to be all, like, bow and arrow battling.
Yeah,
with real bows and arrows.
Maybe I'm just being too conservative here, but I would like the option to just use a classic controller. And moreover than that, I would like to know that they designed the game so that it could be played that way, even if they don't even include the option to use the classic controller. You're like, I just don't want it to be a bunch of shaky, shaky shit.
I think the one thing is, like, if you've got first person stuff at times, like, that's going to be pointer based, so. That could be
a
problem.
I anticipate holding the remote sideways, and that's kind of a...
Well, yeah, because the thing is, if you did that, then you could flip the remote the other way
exactly,
and start shooting once, like, one of these little first-person bits pops up.
That's interesting.
I mean, they've done it. I mean, Nintendo's done it for, what, 3 or 4 games now? This seems like another game.
Yeah, Mario, Punch-Out, a lot of their biggest games last year were NES style.
and the original, was it Super Paper Mario?
Yep.
Yeah, but flipping between holding NES style and pointing at the screen, that would be kind of a new twist on it.
This is what James brings to Super Mario, because he did that a bit.
Yep.
To seek stuff out, to find the little secrets.
It's not a physically hard motion to do either.
It could be a similar thing in the sense that you would do that situationally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot that you did that in Super Paper Mario. It seems like a long time since I played
it. It is. It was. That game is old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That goes back to the very beginnings of this podcast, nearly
yeah,
4 years
Genesis.
Ago. So,
yes. not the Genesis.
Forged in Mount Doom.
The Genesis of RFN. All right. Well, Greg is reading the final letter this week.
Okay, this is from Sergeant Foster, who writes, "Mature games don't sell on the Wii. I think the reason for this, though, is not what's been said before. It's how the Wii was and has been advertised in its entirety. It's a squeaky clean white console, which Japanese business people showing up at your door with fun in hand. You notice the Wii kiosk in your major retailer of choice, and the area is covered with smiling adults and innocent adolescent children. All the boxes are hospital white for the past 3 years, and uniform. The type of gamer that got the Wii day one for themselves is the type of gamer that plays the other two systems, so they have Resident Evil 5 and might have bought RE4 Wii Edition, but are not going to get RE Dark Side Chronicles. That player also probably has COD4, so the conduit isn't going to do it for them. They also like to try new IPs like Mad World, but with no way of checking them out in a demo, they're never going to get round to trying it. The mature crowd is alive and well on the Wii, but we just don't want most of such content because we get our fill on the other systems, or we know it's not a full experience."
Yeah, there's a strong point in there in that, you know, a lot of the people who want these kinds of games on the Wii have had the Wii from the very beginning and, mm-hmm. you know, maybe bought some of those early games like Umbrella Chronicles and Red Steel and stuff like that and got jaded on them.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, after a while, if that's all you get, you're gonna stop buying those kinds of games. You might
To be honest, Red Steel was the only kind of game like that for a while, and it wasn't very good.
Yeah. No, but it sold plenty.
It did, because it was the only option, really.
I guess, I mean, that's the thing. When you look at some of the sales trends, I guess, like, obviously, Dark Side Chronicles has done very much worse by the look of it than Umbrella Chronicles did, mm-hmm. which, you know, was a million seller, I think, worldwide.
Not a surprise.
And there's multiple reasons for that. There's an argument, a pretty strong one, about saturation for those kinds of games on the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You've got the original Umbrella Chronicles, and then, you know, just in that past year you had Dead Space and House of the Dead, and you've had Ghost Squad, Target Terror, obviously.
Yeah,
big one, you know. So I mean, there's a real issue with saturation for what is not a hugely popular genre. But like I said, I think there is another issue possibly with some of these other games, that, you know, some of the people that own Wiis that are amenable to, you know, playing to these kinds of games, you know, it's almost as if there was a kind of radioactive half-life to them playing the Wii.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That just kind of died away, you know, 18 months into it, and they're just
You hear about people all the time who say, "I haven't touched my Wii in a year."
Yep.
You know, they still own them.
And maybe when they do, it's strictly like, you know, the big Nintendo release that kind of everyone's going to get. Or, you know, mm-hmm. it's in a particular franchise that they really liked back on the previous Nintendo systems or whatever. So, essentially, when you talk about the install base, when you talk about the market you've got to sell to, these people have become inert. Mm-hmm. And they're not really people you could sell to anymore. Even though, hypothetically, you could make a good game that would appeal to them. Would it get through at this point?
Yeah, it's hard to reactivate them as consumers.
It's a tricky one because, you know, I don't really want to absolve the third parties of blame in that, because they are somewhat responsible for those people becoming inert in the first place with the low quality of software that they put out for the Wii, largely because they didn't anticipate its success in the early going.
And I think Nintendo is to blame for some of that as well with their software releases.
Absolutely.
I mean, they basically said, "Well, we'll let the third parties handle these mature titles," and then they assumed the third parties would actually handle these mature titles.
Mm-hmm.
Or really didn't care either way if they did, honestly.
I think
they really didn't care.
I think they did care, though, because look at what they've announced in Japan during this press event. I mean, they have Monado, not Monado now, but I mean, they have things like Zangeki no Reginlev. They've got, I mean, these are core titles.
Yeah, it seems like they're branching out in Japan, which is, yeah, I mean, maybe
they're
more
desperate
just
in Japan.
But of course, the situation in Japan is so different because of the lack of the 360 phenomenon and all sorts of, it's more opportunities there. You know, what Sergeant Foster's talking about in terms of the fact that, you know, these people now, they're well catered to on the other systems, and they don't have to or want to kind of apply the effort to kind of monitor what's going on the Wii scene and play those games. Whereas in Japan, where the 360 is, you know, marginal, and then the PS3 is not a huge deal, maybe there is more room for expansion into some of these areas, and that's why they're doing it.
You can even see stuff like that happening with the Monster Hunter Tri with the Black Wii being packaged in with
yes,
it.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, stuff like that doesn't happen in North America because Nintendo, they're not really going to gain anything from that, I don't think.
No, and I think the all white Wii kind of goes into that image thing that he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact they packaged a Black Wii with the Monster Hunter Tri, I mean.
Yeah, and now of course you've got the black cases, which I think he sort of alludes to in the email as well. In Japan, you know, anything that's going to have a C rating, which is sort of like a, you know, getting close to an M at least, in Japan, has got a black case of Zangeki, and they're finally releasing Mad World like a year later.
The black case is a really strange phenomenon that they've adopted. I'm curious to have been in the room when that decision was made. Or when it was first floated, what if we gave our C-rated games a black case?
Well, you know, in some ways, you know, you almost think that they might be more worried about that in America, you know, like they might be more worried that people only know Nintendo through the Wii and they have this perception of it being all smiles and, you know, the happy people and that, you know, there aren't any like mature games on it at all, which is obviously a complete misperception, but
like the Japanese equivalent of M-rated games, giving them a black colored game case, you know, on one hand you could kind of look at it as being parental guidance or something, or trying to protect themselves from misunderstandings at retail, but on the other hand it could be very good marketing to the kinds of people that we're talking about who have, you know, I mean, I think Sergeant Foster makes a great point about the design of the system and the way that it's been marketed with the commercials and the kiosks and everything, because to me, Wii is a very cool looking system, and there is definitely a segment of the population who needs to see their technology, their games, they need to see these things in the light of being really cool. Mm-hmm. And Wii was never really pushed in that direction, especially by Nintendo of America. They never tried to make Wii look cool. They tried to make it look very friendly and maybe hip in kind of a nerdy,
trendy,
middle-aged kind of way, but maybe trendy, but not cool.
Non-threatening.
Yes,
there is a, you know, there are a lot of people who actually care about cool. They respond to advertising, they respond to design in those terms, and they want things more when they look really cool. And the sad thing to me is that we, from an industrial design perspective, I guess, we is a cool looking system if you put it in that light. And I'm just thinking in my head, you know, I mean, you think about the kinds of commercials that you get for Xbox and PlayStation 3 and stuff like that. You know, you could definitely do a commercial for a Wii game where it ends, and instead of showing a picture of the Wii in a naturally well-lit room with a family sitting around on the edge of their seats with stupid grins on their faces, instead you could have a dark room with the blue light on the slot glowing, and then kind of, you know, you zoom out from that and you see that it's the Wii system or something like that. I mean, it's not that hard to do. Like, it's very intentional, and Nintendo of America in particular, although I think Europe's on the same page, Nintendo of America definitely went after a very, very, very different group with their marketing, and they were successful, but I think they probably could have had it both ways.
Well, I suppose the interesting is there's an argument, you know, in the earlier phases, say we want to focus on establishing brand identity with the individual marketing campaigns. So what goes into the marketing campaigns in particular is not necessarily just what's best for that game. Mm-hmm. But it's part of this overall strategy of, you know, every time we put out a game, we're reinforcing something about the brand.
Well, those Metroid Prime 3 commercials.
Yeah, the airport. That's how you get the airport thing, right? Which makes no sense. And
who thought that was a good idea?
No, to be fair to Nintendo of Europe, they didn't go that route with Metroid Prime 3. And they didn't give it the standardized approach. It was more the kind of dark and moody kind of thing going on with it. So a little more differentiation. But I think at this point in the game, where the Wii has sold all these units and has done so, so well, all that, the brand identity is established. So I think even if you were to subscribe to that theory in the first place, that you didn't want to have it both ways, in the early going, you can explore that territory now. But the problem then comes back to this idea of, you know, these inert Wii owners that you can't get to. Would the strategy actually work now? And it's tough. I mean, I still would like to think that, you know, if you put out a good product and market it well and you make use of the Wii's capabilities in an appropriate way, that you can have a hit. I mean, I do think that's possible, but to some extent, because of the sort of sins of the third party developers in the past and because of the strategies Nintendo took and everything, the fact is that is probably harder than it should be.
It's an uphill battle. Some ways.
Yeah,
you have to work harder and get more things right and, you know, get probably a bit more luck to do that than, you know, would otherwise have been the case if you didn't have this really awkward period in the early going where kind of no one really knew what to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of people, you know, maybe they didn't have a 360 and all they had was a Wii, and they're like, you know what, there's really not a lot coming out that I'm interested in. So they went out and bought a 360, so they aren't even checking what Nintendo was doing anymore.
And at this point, you know, with the advent of the Nintendo Channel, Nintendo finally has a way to kind of let people know what's coming out through the system itself. But the thing is, if you haven't turned on your Wii in a year, you're not going to get those updates. I mean, Microsoft does an excellent job. Sony, not quite as much, but Microsoft does an excellent job of advertising the newest games. When you turn on your Xbox, you will know what game came out that week.
Yeah, I mean, if you come back to the Wii from Xbox Live, you're just like, come on.
But I mean, the other thing as well, like the demo subject, which Sergeant Foster touched on, I think is a good one, because, you know, you might be more likely to turn on your Wii every once in a while, even if it's not your primary console for gaming or whatever, if you could play stuff for free. You know, I mean, people like that. You know, you play a bit of content for free, you know, and you know, it's discussion material or it's a bit of fun for a few minutes. Yeah, that's a nice thing. You know, I've done plenty of PS3 games I've really no intention of buying. I'll play just out of interest. And, you know, if you're then using the system more in that capacity, you might find out about what's coming out and then you might actually buy games at retail. This ridiculous approach with demos, you know, with the WiiWare demos, you know, they just took them down. I mean, they're gone again. Like, they had them for, you know, BitTrip and Final Fantasy, Crystal Chronicles, a few other stuff. I got a message, you know, my Wii was glowing blue, and it was to tell me that the demos were about to come down. I said, oh, crap, all right, I'll download that BitTrip demo then now before it's all gone. I don't understand what they're doing.
I guess
with
Nintendo
that
must have ran out of hard drive space, I guess.
Yeah, I think Nintendo's really failed to make a persistent connection to their high-end users this generation. And they used to have, the funny thing is, in the old days, Nintendo were the masters of this. They had stuff like Nintendo Power. You can't get a better conduit of information and promotion to your fan base than something like that. Was so, I mean, if you owned NES and you were into games, you had Nintendo Power.
But, I mean, you can't have, you know, what essentially amounted to party press anymore, because nobody buys magazines for gaming coverage.
Saying companies like Microsoft have discovered the new way to do that, the modern version of
that.
And Nintendo has not. Or they're so late to the party that it's just they can't turn it around.
I think Nintendo has done so many things that they kind of blow off or don't even explain, but can only be construed as them really not caring about that part of their audience. Like, I think of with Brawl, how they no longer, when they cut off accepting user-made
stages.
It went on a long time, but why cut it off?
Well, they might be looking at the numbers and just going, you know, the numbers.
We're only getting 100 of these a week.
But I mean,
not making it worthwhile.
My point is, they don't throw that audience a bone at all. Why take that away?
No, I mean, to be fair, Brawl was a bone to that audience and a way for them to make a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, Brawl really was the ultimate fan service.
Yeah, it's so much
still.
I mean, it was the ultimate fan service of a game that is fan service.
So what? I mean, there's fan service on every console. It doesn't make Nintendo special.
I mean, one of the best things that Nintendo's done for high-level Wii users or heavy Wii users is the storage solution, the SD card channel that we got last year, almost a year ago now. You know, it's easy to look at that and say, well, finally they're listening to us. But I think the real reason they did that was probably pressure from WiiWare developers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm
and,
sure it was.
And not to mention companies like Activision with their Guitar Hero downloadable songs and, you know, Rock Band and stuff like that, where you need to have better access and you need to have faster transfers.
To be fair, I mean, it's interesting because I'm not sure if there's been any movement in this direction in America, but just recently here in Britain, they have launched a new ad campaign for the Wii, which is it looks at multiple online aspects of it. So they talk about WiiWare, they talk about downloading songs for Guitar Hero, and they talk about, you know, playing Mario Kart online or whatever game it is. You know, so it's taken them a while to say the least, but you know, they're sort of at least playing up the online aspects of the Wii at this point. So I mean, it's a gradual drift, but of course it there's always going to be limitations on it in this, you know, generation right now, because the infrastructure was just not set up for it from the start, and you know, doing some sort of overhaul, you know, with the firmware that's like really fundamentally different is probably not going to be something they'd see as worthwhile. Mm-hmm. So I guess the real question is whether these sorts of movements indicate that they'd be willing to really, you know, go back to the drawing board and do it right from the start when they get the next hardware going.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully they see the need for that now. It's interesting, you mentioned the firmware thing, and I never thought about it before, but people praise Sony for adding so many features to the PS3 that weren't there at launch, and they've gotten it to where it's very close to Xbox Live in terms of functionality, except it's still free. And if you think about it, a lot of that stuff Nintendo could have done. I mean, the Wii is just as online as the PS3 is. It doesn't have a hard drive, but at this point, it has the next best thing, basically, with SD cards.
It's certainly, when they launched, they were much more similar in their online strategy.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and at this point, you know, I mean,
their lack thereof in both cases.
Other than the SD card channel, what has Nintendo done with Wii firmware updates? They've delivered plenty of them, but, you know, they added a clock. I mean, it's just nothing really functional except for that storage solution.
I think, if I remember correctly, version 3 is when we got the clock.
Version 3 we did get the clock, yes.
took us to the third main one. And the rest of the ones that seem to be mostly targeted at homebrew.
Yeah, they're trying to shut down piracy and hacking and stuff like that. But they could have, I mean, you know, you talk about friend code systems and stuff like that. Nintendo could have already fixed that. I mean, it's not like that's built into the hardware, you know.
I think it's only that, you know, when you're doing new hardware, you're kind of in that position of having to do things from scratch in the first place,
right,
that it's kind of less additional effort to put these things in.
Well,
in that case, you don't really need to have new hardware to do this at all, but I don't think they will see it as being
the right time.
Yeah, the right time, because it's a whole kind of relaunch thing. And then just it would be as little additional effort as possible.
Yeah. Well, again, a lot of the people who would actually use this stuff have already stopped playing their Wiis if they bought one in the first place. But Iwata seems to think it'll be a while before we get new hardware, so we might be talking about this well into the future. All right, we're going to have to end it right there. Thanks, everybody who wrote in. Every week I'm amazed at the intelligence and the attentiveness of our listeners and the amazing questions that they send in. And we've actually got quite a few that we're still catching up on. So thank you. If you have a question or a comment or a story or a joke or whatever you want to send in, please send that to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We will definitely read it. We might read it on the air even. Be sure to check out our sister podcast. That would be Radio Trivia Podcast Edition and the NWR Newscast. And we'll be back next week with our special Games of the Decade feature. And in 2 weeks, retroactive Super Mario RPG. So don't forget to be playing along there and discussing that in the forums. We will get to it coming up pretty soon. All right, that's all for this week. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Also, the Japanese version of Beautiful Joe.
Nice.
And then just kind of like random. Just some random, like Nintendo DS accessories. And what the heck is this? Some sort of
powder?
No, it's a DS. Anthrax? It's like a DS wallet.
Some sort of powder.
What are you implying?
Oh my god, it's a human head. Oh my god.
Oh yeah. Gosh.